around the circle, and then you can put your feet on the...
If I can put my feet on the...
You, I want you to put your feet up, absolutely.
Okay.
So, here we are.
So this is, we've been talking all week about community engagement from a few different lenses. We began with the week with the question of who am I in the midst of the communities I find myself? And then we wrestled with the question of
within our community, we started with what breaks your heart, what breaks your heart open, what brings you joy and challenges you, and your community.
Yeah. And so looking at the self and then your community, we then wanted to move to this idea of leadership. But we didn't want to do that too soon, because the kind of leadership that we do really needs to be rooted in who we are and who our community is. And so we thought it would be helpful if we spent just a second to reflect on something that breaks your own heart and connects with something that breaks the hearts of people in your community. So give yourself a moment to reflect on that, something that breaks your own heart, and a way in which that might also connect to the heartbreak in your community. And we'll share that using a process called mutual invitation. And so I will begin by sharing mine, and then I'll invite the next person to speak. You are always welcome to speak, to pass, or to pass for now. There's no pressure. We would love to hear what you have to say, but we will not put any pressure on you to say something. The only thing that I do ask is that you invite the next person to speak. Make sense? And if you forget, I'll help you out. So Jeannie and I live in Berwyn, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, about 5 miles. And we live in a very diverse community that's about 60% Latino and 40% other. And in our context, that means that we have a lot of folks who are undocumented. We have a lot of folks who don't have good access to the systems of power. And the ways in which that breaks people's heart really deeply affects me and my ministry as a pastor there. But most significantly, I am also, so I, Jeannie and I have been married forever.
Yeah. 13 years.
13 years.
Of ever.
Yep. I can't do the math anymore. But in my coming out process, I recognized that I had a secret that I thought could destroy me, that could totally upend my life. And so when I am in a community of people who very literally have secrets that they don't have the proper documentation, that could literally upend their life and dramatically change things, that's a place where my heartbreak connects to the heartbreak of our local community. And that, as much as we don't want to be heartbroken people, we are. And it allows me to do that ministry in a way where we're working together. It's a more mutual thing, rather than me telling somebody what they should do, as if I know. So I want to invite you to share something that breaks your heart and a way it might connect with a heartbreak in your community.
This is, I think what breaks my heart is seeing children not either being neglected or taken advantage of. Particularly concerned about human trafficking.
Yeah.
When I read the statistics, I don't have any close connection to that, except that the women of the ELCA being aware of human trafficking, held that up so that we can learn about it. And then in Rochester, we have the Franciscan Sisters, with a Assisi Heights is a facility, which is the mother house of the Franciscan Sisters. And they have really taken on, they are giving a lot of information about human trafficking and doing workshops, and you know, they'll come and they came and spoke to our at our church. And the women organized the day, and I think it just for people to be aware and believe that it's happening.
Yeah.
A big part of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, another one we learned about is Cherish the Children. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's in the ELCA. That is an organization based in the Twin Cities. Being aware and working toward eliminating abuse of children, particularly human trafficking.
So why are you drawn to that work? What in you draws you to that work?
Well, being a teacher, working with children, I suppose, is
deep love.
I haven't taught now for a number of years, but I'm still aware of kids. And having 17 grandchildren and 5 great grandchildren, you think ahead as to
what's next
could happen to them. They, I think, are not at risk in any of ours, you know, in the home like they have right now, but you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Will you invite the next person to speak?
I think I live across the river from you, I guess. I live in Kempton, Wisconsin. So that's just,
We're in Rochester.
And I was just going to write down the Cherish the Children because I'm not familiar with that organization. But we have also, I also was at a presentation given by ELCA women in another, at another church, but it was, I think that's kind of powerful when you have women who look like your own grandmother, you know, just giving you this information and being very clear, very articulate, very passionate about that issue, and not, you know, I mean, it just helps to kind of broaden the, you know, the base of the conversation, because you automatically may trust. In a rural, it's a rural Wisconsin area. And it can be hard to build trust with people who look different and act differently, and you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of kind of ongoing heartbreak with regard to that. My current heartbreak connects to yours, and I think in the position of a pastor who has to hold so many people's secrets. And I mean, I'm a pastor's daughter, so you know, I'm very aware of how that works, that kind of adds to the burden, the burden of a pastor in having to you have to carry so much, and there's not, you're more limited in the ways you can share other people's burdens.
It's
a pretty particular role.
That's a weird job. Yes.
Yeah, it's a weird. I know that. And pastors' families are weird, so I know that too. So I don't want to. You know, that is a fair.
I'm also a pastor.
Yes, I know. I know.
Our poor kid.
You have a 9-year-old.
So, you know, okay. Anyway, so I think my current heartbreak does have to do with the a lot of layers of the current immigration issue, the fact that there are so many differences in people. people, in the way, oh, I don't have the right kind of words. I, you know, opinion isn't the right word, attitude isn't the right word, just kind of the way that the way we receive the realities of life, and it's like, mm-hmm. it hasn't, you know, I feel sometimes like in my community it hasn't quite gotten close enough.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot to try to, you know, in terms of outreach and mission and information, you know, to try to connect people with the far parts of the world, and then, you know, these really critical issues get closer to us, but sometimes not close enough, not
right.
to the point where our communities are directly affected, which means that in my community, it's a very small town on the Mississippi, people just don't, they decide not to talk about it
right.
because they have to get along with each other.
Yeah.
And they don't talk about it because there is so much disagreement. And the things that you assume would be assumptions, basic life assumptions, can get derailed by other forces, by the powers of persuasion of people who can change and control your mind or whatever. And I know I'm being very vague, but I think that's the way the conversation goes in my community.
Yeah.
It's very vague, or people will skirt the issue, say the immigration issue or the issue of our president or whatever. And, you know, sometimes people will kind of put out a little feeler and then they'll adjust their next statement according to what was just said, because they're kind of checking out somebody's attitude, and it ends up not getting anywhere. So I think one thing that's really heartbreaking is our fear of conversation and disagreement, because it keeps everything the way it is, and it seems to be not helpful.
Yeah.
Because I don't like the direction things are going in terms of the way of what we'll accept as people.
Right.
So anyway, so that, you know,
yeah,
I'm
well,
sorry
thank
to
you.
Rail
no,
on.
No, you've stirred some thoughts in my mind, too. Will you invite the next person?
Yes, and should I?
Either one of them.
Oh, okay. I'll keep the circle going then. I can't.
And I also ran for election to the city council 2 years ago and was elected. And I ran in part because I grew up in rural Illinois. My father is a history teacher, and civic responsibility is a big deal. And everyone having an opportunity to be included in the process is a big deal. And we've lived in Berwyn now 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and shortly after we got there, there was an election where the group was running to be on the school board. And they encountered Chicago-style machine politics and were bullied off the ballot. And I got really mad. I think that it's one thing to go up in front of the electorate, try to make your case, and fall short. You're not good against enough people. Well, try again. But for the system to say we like it the way it is and we're going to make sure we win by making sure you're not even involved irritated me a lot. And I got lippy, and I said it to but if you're going to do it, you got to go all the way, even when it's tough. So I was upset with the people who got bullied off the ballot. They didn't go as far as I wish they had, because I think if you're faced with a bully, be standing down. And I said that to my alderman, who was getting ready to run for city clerk, and she said, okay, sucker, put up or shut up. And so I went door to door talking to my neighbors and realizing that so very many of them are disenfranchised. They not have a voice. They do not feel that anything they care about matters to the people who are elected. And so my work is to connect people to the resources that empower them, to be, where necessary, that voice, but always to turn them, I give them phone numbers, I tell them to call the departments and raise their concerns, and then I follow up after them. Mm-hmm. Because I think if we don't figure out, as a people, how to use our voices wisely and persistently, that we will continue to find ourselves being represented by people we don't want representing us. And so that's my entry point into this conversation. Mm-hmm. I have my share of heartbreaks as a hospital chaplain too, but I think those fall more into real life, general, when we're in crisis, who do we turn to? And so in some ways, both of my jobs parallel each other. I connect people to resources that they already have and alert them to resources they didn't know existed and help them to find their own voice. That's why I do what I do. Hi, Roy.
And this is just a recent real life story. So I suppose it was four Sundays ago when a college student who has finished his second year in college, I think, came to church with his mother, and then after church, I didn't talk much with him, but a little bit, and asked him about the summer and where he was working, mm-hmm. and he told me that, and he was a little teary-eyed, and I didn't pursue that because I thought this wasn't the place to pursue it. And later I saw his mother reading a bulletin board, and she also was teary-eyed, and I thought, well, something's going on here that I don't know. Would be 2 years of college, 4 years of high school, so about 6 years ago, I was his mentor while he was in confirmation class, and it was 2 years. That kind of indicates the age that he was then and is now. And when I was his mentor, he showed me some of his make believe writings that he wrote. He loved to be a writer. And he illustrated, and he gave these figures names, and he read that to me one evening when the mentorship took place, either Advent or Lent, or both of those.
Lent.
Yeah, and I commanded him to doing that writing. Okay. Then he went, finished high school, and talked with him every once in a while, and then he went off to college at a distance. And it would be, so then I saw him in church. And then Dorothy walks with another friend, and a week later, we didn't go to church that Sunday. We were elsewhere, town. Yeah. But Dorothy's friend had told her she's a walking companion. Dorothy, this boy had come to the church wearing a skirt.
Okay.
And Dorothy told me about this, and I thought, oh. Now I understand a little bit more.
Yeah.
And then we left to come out here, so I didn't have a chance to talk with him. Well, I'm going to talk with our pastors and commend them because they are very insightful and they are good leaders. About 4 or 5 years ago, we drafted a welcome. application.
Wow, yeah.
And it went through. But if they have visited with him and his family, they are really to be commended for instilling, and this young guy and his mother, the braver to come to church.
Yeah.
Worship that way. A long time ago, our daughter came out to us as a lesbian, and she had a number of two or three partners. And then 2 years ago, this past January, she married her high school sweetheart, a man. After 30 year hiatus, 20 year, 32 year hiatus. So
and she's doing well.
Yeah, she's doing well. They're doing well, and we're doing well. But I no longer, I am no longer much interested in labels, descriptions of people. Leave it there.
Thank you. Well, we wanted to spend a minute. This is really far away.
Shall we move it?
Yeah.
My leg fell asleep while I was sitting there. Where are we going?
Just right here. How's this?
Can you ride on it now?
No.
Can we get that?
Okay. Let's just brainstorm some qualities of a good leader. What makes for a good leader?
Flexible?
Like that. Able to listen.
I reserve the right to spell terribly on a whiteboard.
So far, so good.
All right.
Insight.
Good communicator.
Passion.
Courage.
Confront. All right. Yeah, you can't. It gets in the way if you're afraid of conflict. What else? What else does it take? What are some of the qualities of these pastors that you appreciate?
Oh, open-minded?
Well, our two pastors, and they know how to keep confidential. I had not heard anything about, what took place, and I ought not to have.
Right.
But they're just doing such a great pastoral job.
Great to have those moments of good leadership.
Vision.
Self-aware, and I say that with qualification because I think they're being a Lutheran. I know there are a lot of areas where we're not self-aware. So I mean, just I also want to say trustable. I also know we're not. None of us is completely trustable. So I don't want to elevate this leader to an inhuman.
Well, that,
level.
Let's put human up into it. And a professor once who said, when we not narrow it to being good or bad, but it is that mix.
And I'm transparent.
I also would add that there's somebody who appreciates the power of disagreement. Well, we can keep adding. Do you have anything else burning? We can keep adding to this as we talk, but we want to offer also some additional lenses on what leadership looks like when it goes well. And so I'm going to pass it to Jeannie, who's going to talk about a definition.
So Ronald Heifetz has done a lot of work on adaptive leadership. And he defines leadership with authority. Your ordination, that's authority. It's conferred upon you, right? You get hired to do a job. Mobilizing people to address an adaptive challenge from a position of authority. The authority role brings with it resources and constraints for exercising leadership. The church called you a leader and said these are some of the things you can never do. We were trained from a toolbox in some ways, and there's a pretty powerful toolbox. You're the pastor. Lots of things you can do, but there's some things you can't. Part of what we really want to kind of talk about, specifically today, is leadership without authority. How do you mobilize people to address adaptive challenges by taking action beyond the formal and informal expectations that define your scope of power, such as raising unexpected questions upward from the middle of the organization, challenging the expectations of your constituents, or engaging people across boundaries from outside the organization. Lacking authority also brings with it resources and constraints. We probably can see the constraints a lot easier without authority, right? Who are you?
Yeah.
Who said you could do that?
Yeah, what do you think to do?
Right. But so very many of us find ourselves here in the middle. Even when we have authority conferred from on high, we can find ourselves in pastoral synodical meetings realizing that we're one of many, not the boss. But what does it mean to think about leadership from the middle or from the back? Does this stir questions for you? Do you? I mean, I want to just go to the beginning and say, do you know what an adaptive challenge is? Maybe not.
We'll get into that a little bit in more depth in just a moment, but these are addressing the challenges that we have these days that don't have easy technical solutions. They're complicated.
Heifetz defines a technical solution, or a technical problem, as something that you just need enough time, you've already got the expertise and the resources to take care of. You just need to work it out. I need to learn Spanish. There's 100 ways for me to learn Spanish. I don't have to invent the wheel or think about things in a new way. But as an alderman, I need to communicate with my primarily Spanish-speaking constituents. It's going to take me about 3 years to learn Spanish well enough to have philosophical political conversations. Well, that's a long time. I've got a problem that needs some more energy. It needs to be addressed much faster than 3 years. So I have to adapt. I have to think of new ways to solve my problem. So I have to go and make relationships with people who speak Spanish too and ask them to go with me. Figure out ways to coordinate so that when I'm in a gathering with people who may or may not speak English, there are people who support at least listening to me. Maybe not my ideas, but a willingness to transfer them to other people. And that's real work. But finding that solution means I have to get out of my box is the easiest thing. To pull myself up by my bootstraps and work harder thing is to go learn Spanish. May or may not solve my problem. That's an adaptive kind of challenge. Does that make sense?
So
anytime we find ourselves in the church, there's often somebody who says we've never done it that way before.
Mm-hmm.
It may be an indication that we have a technical versus an adaptive problem.
Yeah, so here's a chart that goes into defining what those things are. When we've got a technical problem, the computer won't start. It's usually clear how to fix it. Often it involves hiring somebody who knows. But when we get to an adaptive problem, it requires learning. The solution requires learning. The stakeholders need to be involved in that. And often we come from or are part of organizations that don't do learning well. Because it means change. And how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb?
Change.
Change.
So in this question of change, who are the change makers in your world? Who in your community, in your life, who makes change?
Good question.
How about in your house? Start small.
Dogs. The new dog. That makes change.
We live in a condo, and so if something happens, you know, it can change the fees, or it can change.
Mm-hmm.
That would be something.
Mm-hmm. You didn't always live in a condo.
Pardon?
You didn't always live in a condo.
No.
Who, in the old days, when change happened, who was responsible for that?
Right? You moved in, not because it was conferred upon you. You
no.
were not.
You were there. Dubbed,
but you stepped into that role, mm-hmm. and you did it graciously. Yeah. So in the, I used to do some work in software, and we would often, we would make products that didn't work as well as one thought they might. We also made some really great products. But the ones that didn't work as well as we wanted them to, invariably they would have what we called a kludge in them. Where we were doing a messy sort of just make it work, let's get duct tape together to just let this machine run, even if we can't be certain that it will. Versus actually doing something that is elegant, that solves the wholeness of the problem. And so this movement from technical leadership to adaptive leadership is trying to move us away from these kludges of duct taped together to being able to engage in a system and really take a full sense of what's going on, to be able to learn, to be able to move to another place and adapt to the realities that we face. So when we're considering how does lawns and gardens get done at Holden Village, there are the technical problems of let's make sure the lawnmowers work. But there are also the adaptive problems of what does this environment need now after the Wolverine fire? What does this environment need to maintain itself well into the future? And that's not as simple as fixing the lawnmower. You can't go to school and get that one.
Right. And I'll just add that the technical problem of fixing
fixing the lawnmower, you can get a manual for that. You can find an expert to fix that. But as you move into adaptive challenges, there are places for experts.
They will.
But they join a team. And bringing all of the stakeholders together, or as many as you can, realizing that the problem is not as simple as the carburetor. That takes a whole new way of seeing the world. And some of us, we're not raised in that world.
Mm-hmm.
We were raised in the get or done world. I don't want to talk about it, I don't want to plan about it, I don't want to reflect about it. Does that resonate with any of you? As a, that part of what I do as a chaplain, I also train chaplains. And so I help my students start to see what it means to take themselves and their self-awareness, their own history and their traditions and their own thinking into rooms of strangers who have all of their own sets of values and thinking and ways of being in the world. And how do you engage and cross that border to sit with them and understand how they work so you can be helpful? That's my immediate application, but also as an alderman. I knock on people's doors and I have to figure out what matters to them. Because what matters to me is that we stop blowing the budget. It just does. Right now, that's my bottom line. But it is not the bottom line of the people I knock on their door. If they work for the city, they don't want to lose their job. If they need city services, they don't want them cut. If they live in an alley and everybody in Berwyn does, they want it fixed yesterday. Sick of potholes. They're sick of sidewalks that don't look good. They want their garbage collected. But all of those things impact the thing that is most important to me, the budget. But as I'm talking with them, what I want has to go in tandem with what they want or we'll never have a conversation. And so they become the stakeholders, that's
mm-hmm.
the word. And so as I'm teaching my students to think about the ways people think, almost all of us are part of this first level, this socialized mind. It's really easy for us to understand what being a team player is. We can be faithful followers. We're just kind of geared that way. Have you guys, you've got grandchildren, you've watched them being educated in school. What's one of the first things we teach our children in school? Universal big umbrella teaching.
Line up.
Line up.
Yeah.
We align them with each other and the teacher and the expectations. And we teach them to look to the front of the line to see where they're going to go and what they need to be doing. It's really great if you've got a passel of kindergartners, because they're dangerous. and we make them reliant. It serves a really important purpose. If you've got 30 kids in the classroom, those are important things. If you've got people who are milling about, line them up. Come get your coffee here. Start here, work your way back. It will make sense in our culture and our society. But those, and this socialized mind are really good at technical problems. Does that make sense? Who knows how to fix it? The expert. And if I want to know how to fix it, I go to become an expert on carburetors so I can fix lawnmowers. But if we've got a problem about how Holden fits in the new environment, in the new ecosystem after this fire, what else do we need? You want your fire guys. You want your mechanics. But you also want somebody who can be agenda-driven, who can figure out their own plan. And you want somebody who can learn to lead all of those other people. They've got their own sense of what's important. That doesn't mean they don't listen. Right? We like listeners. And they're problem solvers. Outside of the box problem solvers. Part of our problem is our education system has
has a real problem with these folks. Have you seen those lines? You got all the ducks going and you got the one kid who's doing this.
That was Jeannie.
There's some opposing, competing agendas in how we bring people up. But almost all of the problems that are facing us today are problems that need to be addressed by people who can get outside of the box. Otherwise, we find ourselves with election results that we may or may not like. Because somebody walked up to them and said, look, I know how to do it. I can fix all your problems tomorrow. Mexico's going to pay for it. It'll be great. It serves a certain understanding of the world. We need an expert. This is a developmental model by Robert Keegan. He does adolescent and adult development. We all start here. We actually start down here where I am the only important thing in the world. Then occasionally my mother starts to slip in and she becomes very important. But it's me and her. And then we expand to familial, which is a very small nuclear family sort of thing. And then eventually, fairly quickly, 5, 6, certainly by 10, we become socialized. The reality is that most of us spend most of our life there because the demands don't force us to go anywhere else. But our culture is getting faster and faster, and there are more and more demands, and people are being drawn into self-offering.
I think also, so this is a growing in our capacity to hold complexity. And as a pastor, I have come to really understand that part of my job is to create a space where we can enter into greater complexity. So much of the world wants us to simplify, but actually we are called to hold the complexity of God's creation, and it is infinitely complex. The other thing about this that I really appreciate is that as we move up in time towards that self-transforming mind mode, which Jeannie will talk about more in a minute, these are our elders. These are, I'm sure as you have gotten older, you have noticed the greater complexity of the world, and you are able to hold it in a very different way than you could when you were young.
Is that true? I'm really hoping that you say it's true.
Yeah.
Nancy?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm saying, yeah. No, absolutely.
And so this is, as I consider in our culture, as we need each other. We absolutely need each other because of that capacity to hold greater complexity and to know that the solutions are not as simple as ABC.
So you guys are looking at this and you're listening to us right now. What do you think? What comes up for you?
Well, I think, you know, take the issue of climate change. You know, we're hearing so much, I'm trying to put that in, you know, where is the acceptance of science and, you know, trying to find that along the line.
Right, right.
And our daughter happens to be involved in a group, let's see now, if I can think of a letter, Climate Congress. It's an organization where it means, and communities have groups, and they go to the leaders, you know, representatives, senators, what, and ask for their participation in learning more about it and moving forward in we do to make things better? And it, it has to, if they, if it gets, it's into political, if they get a person to agree that, if, let's say as a Democrat, they can't get another Democrat until they get a Republican.
Oh, wow.
So it has to
intentionally
stay neutral.
Holding that place of disagreement.
And that it, it's really making sense to me to see what they're,
mm-hmm.
how they're working that.
Mm-hmm. Because the problem with climate is very complicated.
Yeah.
And it has far more to do, at least here in the United States, with how people think instead of with what is going on outside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're, that they figured out a pretty important thing.
Yeah.
The word meta,
mm-hmm.
with the
meta leader?
Meta is
overarching.
Yeah.
I would trans Uber. But it's much more of a, you don't really know that you've been led by a meta leader. You don't really know that they have a plan and a vision that they're executing.
Mm-hmm.
They just sidle up along with you and it becomes your idea.
Our neighbor, we live in a small condominium building, and their neighbor lives in a house next door, and his license plate is Meta.
Uh-huh.
You notice that?
No, I didn't notice that.
Well, now it's starting to come through to me, and that's because he wrote for a newspaper, and he teaches writing, and the last 4 or 5 years he's in his large house. He has a Buddhist meditation group that meets weekly.
Yeah, I would ask him to tell you what it means.
Yeah.
Because it's always better to ask a chaplain tells people.
Yeah.
you have something.
Oh, just in my field, the way it's applied, I'm a speech language pathologist, retired, but when they look at things like metalinguistics, metacognition, you're looking at it as it applies to developmental stages, maybe, you know, when you go into a metalinguistic stage, you're able to look at yourself, or you're able to look at language.
Mm-hmm.
Metacognition, you look at yourself as a thinker, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of that, like
you
said,
yourself
that
becomes
over
part of the reflection.
Yeah.
It's not just self-awareness, it's self-observation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
right. Yeah. We got some of that up there as well. That self-awareness is important.
No, go ahead. I'm
no, I just want to. Julie said I was going to spend some time on this self-transforming mind.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to spend very little time on it because the truth is that for most of us, you know, I'm going to die too early to find myself very significantly in that role. I think that I think it does require experience and age and meeting constantly demands that are further than where I'm at now. And it's the reaching, it's the trying to figure out how to solve that just out of reach problem that moves us from one developmental stage to the next. And so if it's all easy, we don't learn. If this kid never gets out of line and figures out that he didn't get nailed too hard, he'll stay in line, right? It's those challenges and opportunities that move us to the next space. So that's all I wanted to say about that.
And that kind of relates to what my question was. I was curious because it seems like between the first two levels, you could almost see a linear movement that's possible,
mm-hmm.
or an evolution,
yeah,
maybe, and then it's almost a quantum leap into the self-transforming mind, because you're always dealing with all the other levels, and then something as you hold that as something that maybe beyond death or whatever, you are still always be cast back into the other, and as a an alderman, I'm sure.
Oh, there's plenty of things that return me to my crowd.
Yeah, because the world around you is always, is there, it's pulling back.
Well, and constant changes and challenges.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope I sound somewhat reasonable here, but there are plenty of days where I am not reasonable about the budget. And I'm hard to talk to. And it's the, you know, where am I being a leader and where am I being an activist? Becoming active about this thing? Where are they the same? Where are they diametrically opposed? If I'm doing the work, am I leading others to the work? Is one of the questions. I particularly like the leader learns to lead in self-offering. Spend a lot of time trying to figure out what do I need to do today to get people to consider joining me. That's pretty huge. That's my humble attachment to, you know, how do I acquire power? To the self-transforming mind, the leader leads to learn. It's just a fundamental different shift, right? I'm leading, I'm just going to claim something I don't have. I'm leading you so I can learn more and more and more. Because learning about this new thing is transformative. It's a great place to dip my toes into, but like I said, I get jerked back a lot. What do you guys think about that as an idea? Does it resonate with anything? Does it stir up thoughts?
I feel like I have a few moments of that in my congregation when I'm able to do that. Those are the moments when people will discover that I've roped them into doing something without knowing that I had done it. and then they actually have this phrase called being Pastor Julied as a verb. That it is that moment when people are coming together to do things, and they recognize that they have more power and capacity to do those things than they realized. And I have definitely had a role in shaping that, but I'm fairly sneaky about it.
They think it's their idea.
They do.
So when you, so this is a bunch of ideas. This is theory, which, you know, we'll give you the book so you can look them up later. But when you think about what you mentioned about your heartbreak, when we asked you to introduce yourself, a problem in your community, an issue, a real thing. When you think about leadership to address that where you live, what do you think? Comes up for you?
Well, in our city of Rochester, right now, for the last about 4 or 5 years ago, the theme was Destination Medical Center.
Absolutely, sure.
Destination Medical Center. And we've lived there since January of 1988, and I thought that it is a destination medical center now, with Mayo hospitals and clinics and all kinds of research. And University of Minnesota just started a full program there now, but it's to grow. In 20 years, they plan to double the size of Mayo, and it might cause. That might mean that doubling the size of Rochester. We moved there in January of 88 and it was 69,000. Now it's 106.
Oh, wow.
And, but a big problem, affordable housing. Because it's the people that mop the floors of the hospitals and keep schools clean that make the world go around.
an adaptive problem.
Yeah, completely an adaptive problem, right.
That will change dynamically with each 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think there are,
So who's?
58 languages.
I'm sure. I'm sure. My hospital background, that makes complete sense to me. So, who is the leadership in your community around that issue?
Well, the Destination Medical Center Initiative has a committee.
Yeah.
Task force, but it all has to be run through the city council.
Yeah.
And every new hotel that's gonna be built has to be approved and all.
Who's deciding? I'm asking the same question over and over again. Cause I'm on city council and I know how those decisions are made. Who's deciding?
Right.
Who's making the pitch and who's watching the decision and holding them accountable? Your city councilman, that's an obvious person, right? The medical, developers, huge stakeholders.
Yeah.
They're very helpful to your city council person. Very helpful. Let me give you the information you need. Right? Where's the community?
And that's what I was, you know, people need to be going to those city council meetings.
Yeah.
You know, which we haven't done yet.
Do you feel energy to do that?
Not right now.
Fair enough. I think that, part of what, that's a pressing issue. It's a real thing. 20 years from now, you will not recognize where you live now. It's true. But where our heartache meets our passion, we can make change. Where our annoyance meets our issue, sometimes that makes us not a leader. It makes us a griper, which is a perfectly fine role.
There is a role for complaining. So in our, my church has a community development organization that does things around justice and leadership and relationship in our community. We seek to be a catalyst for those things. And part of the work that we do then is to come alongside groups of people who show some passion about something that breaks their heart in their community. And one of the first projects that we considered doing was looking at the issue of sewer backup in Berwyn. During some of those big, awful storms that we get in Chicago.
That are 50-year storms. Over and over and over.
Yes. We will get, in many parts of our community, we will get sewer backup, the sewage will actually come into people's basements, which is many levels of awful. So, recognizing that there was some passion there, I did the work with some other folks to gather people who were passionate about it to sit down and see what we could do. We called it the Sewer Summit. And as folks sat around, it became really clear to me that they didn't actually want to lead on this. They wanted to complain. And there's a place for complaining. As a pastor, we receive people's complaints as a recognition of the pain that they're experiencing. But to transform that into the work of creating real change is a different animal altogether. So we didn't go any further. There wasn't the energy to make it happen.
To complicate the matter, apparently once you've cleaned up the sewage in your basement and you go 3-4 months with no problem, it's a little bit like labor.
You forget.
It's not a problem right now, and I have other screaming children to take care of. And if, God forbid, we were to have a continuous problem, then then we could get down to the brass tacks of what will it cost to redo our entire sewer system and separate stormwater from groundwater? That's the the technical term. We have a combined sewer system and have had since we were created, and we are the last stop before it hits the water treatment facility. Mm-hmm. So all the water in the surrounding region goes through us. Mm-hmm. So we have huge torrents in those pipes, and the little bitty pipes in our houses can't. We never have enough pressure to combat them. But if it's not raining, we don't care.
Now, alternately,
yep.
We have another group of folks in Berwyn who decided we have a problem around justice because we don't have a newspaper. The local news organizations don't cover Berwyn. We're not exciting enough.
I think actually they could find plenty of exciting.
Oh, there's stuff to talk about. But that's a gossip column.
And so it ends up being that people in, particularly in political power, can really take advantage of folks in our community because there's no way to actually find out the news unless you're really in the city space. The mayor's my,
the mayor doesn't like me anymore.
It's also true that we've got a lot of people who are undocumented, who come from cultures where engagement of the power structures doesn't work. And so we don't, in that regard as well, we don't have a way of knowing one another's story, of building community together. And we do have a group of people who have been working for about a year now to move actively towards getting a newspaper in town. And they're making real progress. It's a tall mountain to climb in this climate, but because they have the passion and the leadership and they recognized it as an adaptive problem, not just something they can complain about, they are actually truly making progress, and it's exciting to see.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things about that is that there is this core of folks who are leading, mm-hmm. but then there's this ring of people who are interested, but who don't want to lead, per se, who find the right moment to ask the important question. And so they are, in fact, equal, in my mind, to the core leadership. Mm-hmm. Because it is the truth is, everybody can't be in the front. Mm-hmm. How did your church go when everybody wanted to be in the front? It wasn't so fun. You had somebody in the front.
And it doesn't work in your work either with doing speech therapy. There is a clear, defined role that needs to happen. Mm-hmm.
So, what does it mean to lead without authority?
Without
authority. You're not part of the core team. Rochester's development is a big deal, and you care about it, but you don't want to become a leader. I hear that right now. Okay? But are there places that you could occasionally show up and be supportive and make a difference?
And ask those questions from your deep understanding of the complexity of the world. And using the gift that we bring to that. So, are we ready to move to the next thing? So one of the adaptive challenges that I know well in my community is that we come from different cultures. Do you have a sense of coming from different cultures in the communities where you live?
No.
Not so much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All pretty homogenous?
Pretty homogenous. Yeah. And I came from Southern California, so I have a...
Okay, so you have a sense of that.
So I entered a culture that was very homogenous.
Where are you living now?
Pepin, Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Across the river?
Yeah, it's like down the Mississippi from the Twin Cities, okay. About an hour and a half.
And in your community, do you
there's a pretty good amount of diversity.
How many language did you say?
I think it's over 50.
Yeah, that's some diversity.
Yeah.
So
leadership. We have, in my community, we have so many different ways in which leadership is seen. We've got first-generation immigrants, many of whom are from Mexico, where there's an understanding that the authority structure is empowered to make the decisions and that there's not much we can do to affect them. Then we've got a whole bunch of folks who've been in power and leadership for a long time who really think that we can do whatever we want and we really don't have to ask for permission from anyone. And then we've got second and third generation immigrants who straddle so many different realities in a way that's not necessarily examined. So in the field of intercultural communication, we talk about some of this in terms of high power difference and low power difference cultures. I'll show you this other slide that might. So and by low, I don't mean, I merely mean that the distance of power between people is small. That we presume when we walk in the room that we are more or less equal. But there is, that is, and it changes, but more or less equal completely appropriate for me to walk into a room and just presume that I get to start talking. But in a high power distance culture, that is not the case. There is a powerful elite who makes the decisions, and there's a lot of difference between the top and the bottom. Now, it may be that you immediately are drawn to the sense of one is better than the other. I want to invite you in that adaptive mode to simply be curious about this high power distance reality. We as a people of faith recognize that God has come to all of us and all of us equally. And the writings of Paul are pretty awesome, actually, in the way he subverts the power structures of the day, of bringing more people into the circle than expected. But when we consider our work with people of other cultures, to immediately go in and say the way you are doing it is wrong does not help us and is not adaptive. So an invitation to be curious about this. So some of the ways in which we see this then is that in a low power distance culture, we see that you should have a legitimate claim to power. So I got a Master's of Divinity, so I have the legitimate claim to some knowledge about the Bible. I got ordained, so I have a legitimate claim to the authority of leading a church. In this low power difference thing, reality, we come together and we believe that we have a capacity to change the system. We might ask for volunteers and we will expect to get them. Powerful people will wear jeans and come into a space and be look just like everybody else. You don't need to wear, some of my colleagues will say, I don't need to wear a collar because I've got that authority already. And they're not wrong, but it's a cultural perception about their power as well. So in a high power difference culture, and this is actually the way most of the rest of the world operates, there is a hierarchy. The superior and subordinates, they won't mix. So you're not going to have a party, a meet and greet kind of thing. We're going to keep people separate. Many people don't have access to higher education, and there is a concerted effort to keep people in their place. people will enter into a space and believe that they cannot change the environment. And in order to become a leader, you must be invited to do so. And if you're not, that's just the way things are. So the way that then that you change that dynamic, the way you change leadership, is by having a revolution, by overthrowing the systems of power. So in so in my community, we were working on a so the school district had decided that they wanted to move towards grade centers as a way of doing their teaching. So closing down a couple of schools and moving kids. So kindergarten through second grade would be in one building, and then they would third through fourth in another, and so on. And the community members saw that that was going to be a problem. From a research standpoint, it actually is not ideal. From a community strength standpoint, to have to, if you have five children and you have to take them to five different schools, how are we going to do that? So there were so many levels of problems, and we, this community development organization we started, then came alongside a bunch of parents who were very concerned about this. Many of whom came from cultures of high power difference. One of which was this woman from Argentina. She'd grown up during the dictatorship. And she said to us, "Can I actually speak about this in public?" She really honestly didn't have a sense that that's what you could do in the United States. She, in part, she said, because in Argentina, had I even dared to think outside the box I was given, I could have been shot in the head. Mm-hmm. And so when we're coming and doing leadership in communities where there is a different understanding of how power works, we have to do some real adaptive work to walk alongside folks to help them have access to the systems that come more naturally to us. So we gave her the microphone, and it was powerful. Incredibly powerful. But another way in which another story about how this differential has gotten me, we were working on a sanctuary city ordinance in Berwyn. And I was working with some Latina first-generation immigrants who are fabulously powerful women who have taken on the systems quite against what their culture has said is okay to do and not okay, and have done it in absolutely awe-inspiring ways. But they also just deeply embedded, just as showing up on time is something that we do. Deeply embedded in that is a deference to authority. Authority is honored in a deep way. So they came, and I knew that. And so they came to me and said, this organization we're working with, PASO, is not doing this work in the way we want them to. They are not listening to us well. We want a meeting with them. They're not building up our power. They're building up their own. And the list of complaints was long and significant. So I received that, recognizing that I come from a low power distance and they come from a high power distance reality. I felt pretty good about myself. And then I go to PASO, that is an organization of second generation Latinas. So these are folks who are straddling both realities. And I come from recognizing this high power difference group has asked me to go and argue on their behalf, to a group that is actually operating more in this low power difference. different reality. And also is suspicious, and rightly so, of a white woman telling them their business. I stepped in it deep. It was awkward and awful. And that's part of leadership too. You adapt to those moments. But it's really helpful to have that frame for what was going on. It's not personal, it's just that I stepped in it. You seem to have
I was just wondering what I wanted to hear more.
Oh, sure. So they got mad at me. They got we didn't get our meeting, but we were actually able to get the Sanctuary City thing passed. And that was that story is a fun story of leadership.
Yeah,
that's true.
Political things are political. And that was during the election, and the folks I ran with were typically more progressive and really pushing for these issues. And PASO and the BCA came to talk to several of us who'd just gotten elected and asked us to make it happen. But the reality is we've got a 4-4 split in our council to be decided by the mayor, and who was on the other side. And we all looked at each other and said, we are completely and utterly behind this. We are in full support, but you can't win here if you don't convince the mayor. So stop talking to us. Go talk to the Hispanic aldermen who are on his ticket. Convince them. And if all of them get in line, he will come with, because we're already with you. But that's where the work is. And we can't do it because he hates us. And so they went to each individual alderman, three of them, two men and a woman, and made their case. And the case was, your entire constituency will kill you if you don't get on this. It's as clear as that. This is a Hispanic, Latino issue. And how can you not be for them? And if you're not for them, we'll be very loud about why you're not. And suddenly the mayor was all for it.
Well, there was another part of that story too.
Well, there was.
They wanted to say we're in favor of this, it's just gonna take some time to do. And it was going to take forever to do, because justice can't wait. One of the aldermen who was outgoing, who was not on the mayor's ticket, submitted a resolution to be passed.
She submitted it on Tuesday. It's due on Thursday.
And she said, if you all want to put in your own resolution that is as good or better, I will withdraw mine. They didn't want her to get the credit.
They had a pretty good ordinance.
So on Thursday,
they
had their... Now when you hear the story told, that is not in anyone's narrative. When people were taking credit for making this happen, Marge's subversion was never part of it. But it was absolutely an adaptive response to a situation where there was also a high power difference going on.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome.
It was, and it was fast.
It was really fast.
But in some places, that's how change happens. Mm-hmm. Figuring out an ordinance that would protect some of the cultural aspects of Rochester today, now's the time to do that. If you've got any interest in that, because the developments will take over.
And I think going back to that previous, this slide here, the systems that want to take advantage of us really want to keep us in this socialized mind area. They really don't want us to move forward, because we're less easy to control and manipulate in those other areas. end of our time, and I want to take a moment to just reflect on what you might be called to do, to be, or to change in this moment, reflecting on what we've talked about today. What might you be called to do, to be, or to change? We'll use mutual invitation again.
Can I have a minute too?
Yeah. You're gonna always pass or pass for now?
Mm-hmm. I think the thing in front of me right now is building up leadership throughout my ward and across the ward boundaries. It's not, none of the work that I want to do can be done just by me. And finding the space to listen to what everyone else needs to, and building coalitions so that we can get things done together, is my current work. I think that's true for me. I'm sticking with the city right now.
That's a tough one to answer because I'm in this period of transition where I'm going to have to look now at, you know, at how retirement's going to look.
Mm.
But I think that one of the things I'm being called to do is to be part of the changing face of the church and to help. I haven't figured out yet what that means, but I think that it's not going to, the face is going to not look the same everywhere, and it has to have a face in our community, but it's not the same face as it has in Rochester,
right, yeah.
In Texas, and Argentina, or Rwanda, or I mean, it's just, what does it all mean? Somehow, I want to be part of what that means, and I'm not sure yet.
It's truly an adaptive challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge, as an adaptive challenge. Dorothy.
What came to my mind was choosing a focus. Because there are so many things.
Right.
So many areas to pick from. Mm-hmm. And I have to just decide, I think, what direction to go to. Should be more in, because of our daughter and her husband with this climate change, you know, maybe I should, because all kinds of information from them and with them, and maybe pick something to focus on rather than kind of like, oh my, this needs attention,
right.
This needs, you know. It
becomes overwhelming.
Well, I want to explore one factor that took place in our church, and I think that's what I plan to do.
That's great work.
To explore that.
Vital life giving work,
yeah.
So I have a Latina intern who is remarkably gifted in a system that I worry will take advantage of her gifts or not see them. And so I think in this moment I'm called to do the work of adapting to the challenges that are in the midst of that. And walk with her so that she comes from a high power differential culture. And that means that she often ends up being in a position of wanting the authority to say, this is what you need to do now. But in our system, if she does that, then the authority sees that as she isn't really engaged. I mean, it's two different things. And so I feel really called in this moment to translate that divide.
So, it's dinner time. Did you all know?
Yes.
Our child is upstairs.
Yeah, our alarm clock just went off.
Oh, I see.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I hope your stay is lovely and that the discernment that you need to make is easier.
Yeah, these are good people to do that with. Thanks so much.
Thank